Consider these words from the 22nd verse of the opening chapter of the Epistle of James. Be doers of the word and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. It's just a little bit ironic that the theme we are given to consider this morning at nearly the end of the season of summer vacations is the dreary theme of work. We are invited by the collect, you might have noticed, the fruit of good works, the epistle that Dr. Strayer read that talks about works, and by the gospel to reflect on how exactly a Christian disciple should be known in the world, what it is that should distinguish us or make us recognizable to the world outside the church. And the answer is as clear as it is uncomfortable. The Epistle of James has had an impact on the history of Christianity way out of scale to its small size. The whole letter is just 5 chapters, only 4.5 pages in my Bible and probably in yours too. And yet, the ideas in this little letter have been the source of contention and confusion almost since the moment they were written. The reason for that is maybe a little hard to get until you start reading this letter side by side with the letters that Paul wrote to the churches that he started. And if you do that, you begin to see that there is something of an argument going on between them. An argument about how Christian people should live in the world. And even though the argument itself started 2,000 years ago, the terms of it really affect us here and now. So I'm going to spend the next few Sundays, these 5 weeks out of a 3-year cycle that we get to hear from the Epistle of James, to look at that argument and to situate us in it. It's important for us to remember and reflect on this basic disagreement that goes to the very beginnings of our faith, this difference of views, not so much about the why, but about the so what. Let's clear away one little obstacle right at the beginning. The Epistle of James was probably not written by somebody named James. It was written by someone who disagreed with Paul and who ascribed it to James. Not either of the Jameses who were members of the 12 disciples, but James, the brother of Jesus, a person who became revered and respected among Christians in the earliest Christian community gathered around Jerusalem. In many ways, the Epistle of James is a very Jewish document, a Jewish document of a particular type. It reads like other readings emerging from the Jewish community at about the same time in a genre that we now speak of as wisdom literature. Writings that include some of the books in the Apocrypha, the books in Hebrew tradition written at about the same time as the earliest Christian writings. One of the critiques early commentators made of the letter of James was that it only mentioned Jesus twice. Once in the very first line, and then once again at the beginning of the 2nd chapter, which we'll hear next week. Much more emphasis in this little letter is given to God the Father, the God the Jewish community would recognize as Yahweh, the God of Abraham. But that is really a detail. What is more than a detail is the theology of this letter, because that is where the argument really starts. Paul has a very specific idea about not just how Christianity works, but what it is supposed to mean at the level of each individual Christian. For Paul, the power and promise of Christianity was that it meant we no longer had to earn our way into God's good graces by means of observing the laws of the covenant code. That's what Jesus is talking about in the gospel this morning. And Paul would have known about that argument. Jesus is critiquing the Pharisees' radical insistence on absolute observance of the letter of the law. For Paul, this whole notion of the work of Jesus meant that the expectation of observance, an expectation that had become a means by which the Jewish authorities exercised power over people who just wanted to be in relationship with God, that all was replaced by the gift of faith, and specifically, faith in the redeeming work of Christ. Most of us know that for St. Paul, the covenant of laws had been replaced by a covenant of faith. Things like the laws about diet and the things that made you clean and unclean, all of that was water over the dam. All that mattered now was to understand and to believe that Jesus was the promised Messiah of God and that Jesus had restored our relationship with God through the work of the cross. But the author of the Epistle of James sees this idea as good only so far as it goes. Because we are still set in the world. We are still actors on this stage. We don't suddenly sit back because of Jesus and spend the rest of our lives in holy contemplation of the good work Jesus has done. Our lives are meant to have purpose. And the purpose of a Christian life is to bear the fruit of our faith in the works we do in the world. It may seem like a small difference, this difference in perspective between Paul and James, but a lot comes from it. There's a very difficult and complicated history that comes from the idea of the works of faithful people. It does not take long for the central idea of James's epistle to become a little bit convoluted and turned into the arguments that our works somehow gain us favor with God. And we all know the critique that Martin Luther leveled against that idea. But it is not a fair reading of this document, of the Epistle of James, to say that this little letter is defending a doctrine of salvation by works, because it's not. It's more to understand James as arguing that Christians are meant to be people of action, not contemplation, or at least not only contemplation. If our faith means anything at all, it should change us. And that change should bring about something from us. It should get us to get up and do good things in the world, to care for the people who are vulnerable and needy, to look after the people who are hurting. So if you see it in that way, those of us who gather in church are not supposed to be here for our own comfort. We're supposed to be here to equip ourselves for work. We're supposed to be here to condition ourselves as deeply as possible as people who live in gratitude to God. A gratitude that our acts, our work, our way of being in the world will be a reflexive, spontaneous act of praise. We don't just do this like that. We do it little bit by little bit. When we are children, we are made to do good things by our parents, even when we might want to do otherwise. Our moms and dads create opportunities for us to do good works. To bake in the kitchen downstairs, dessert for Monday's soup kitchen. And by doing so, help us understand how those acts connect to the character they hope we will build in ourselves. And eventually we take on these tasks for ourselves. We do these good works of our own volition, even though it may not be because we want to. It may be to burnish our reputation or strengthen our college application or win the admiration of someone. But in the end, as our faith deepens and shapes us, these things become quite literally second nature. We don't even have to think about them. Indeed, the less time spent thinking about them, the better. They come out of us almost spontaneously. And if we really get it right, they come out of us joyfully. Because we begin to understand that our whole lives are meant to be lived as a response, a grateful response to God's gift to us. Now, I don't know about you, but I am pretty attracted to the contemplation idea. I love the idea of sitting back and thinking about all of this. The whole idea of the Christian faith is so compelling, so interesting and challenging an idea that if you think about it, even for a little bit, you quickly find that it's worth thinking about a lot. But the warning of James this morning is that this is not enough. The hallmark of Christian faith is meant to be something that has impact in the world where actions make change. God's gift to us is our faith. Our response in return is to do the work in the world God needs done. Amen.